Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Counsel. My name is Brett Langner. I'm an Assistant Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the defendants' appellants, James Massey, Brent Hoffman, and John Liefer in this matter. Your Honors, this Court should reverse the District Court's denial of these defendants' motion for judgment as a matter of law for two reasons. The first reason is that Williams did not present sufficient evidence which would permit a jury to conclude that he suffered an objectively serious medical need that was deliberately ignored by the defendants in violation of his Eighth Amendment rights. The second reason is that the defendants are entitled to qualified immunity. To start, Your Honors, to prove a claim of deliberate indifference, Williams must meet the subjective and objective tests. The objective element requires that a deprivation by prison officials be sufficiently serious. What that means is that the official's act must result in the denial of the minimal civilized measure of life's necessities. As the Supreme Court explained in Hudson versus McMillan, extreme deprivations are required. It simply is not the case that every ailment a prison suffers and every delay or denial of treatment.
You wouldn't deny these are the classic symptoms of a heart attack, would you?
These certainly had the same symptoms as a heart attack. That is true. It was not, in fact, a heart attack.
Well, that doesn't matter, does it?
Well, it does matter to an extent.
Well, isn't there an element of risk involved here? I mean, it seems to me if you have the classic symptoms of a heart attack, you have the risk of the patient dying, and something ought to be done about it promptly.
Well, there's an element of risk, Your Honor, that's true, and that goes to the subjective element, which isn't in play on this appeal.
Well, what's subjective about risk? That's a pretty objective thing if you die of a heart attack.
That's true. But it's also the case that these symptoms have to be looked at in the context in which they were. In fact, it was not a heart attack. In fact,
we discovered that after we examined the patient at leisure. But I can assure you that all advice given to heart patients is to treat the symptoms seriously and do something about them promptly.
And I completely understand that, Your Honor. And again, ultimately he was treated, and ultimately it was not a heart attack. You know, which brings me to, for instance, the supplemental authority that we cited, which was the Henderson case. In Henderson, this court held that chest pains, dizziness, and breathing problems were not sufficiently objectively serious to meet the first element of the deliberate indifference test. Here, Williams had chest pains, and he was dizzy, and he had some nausea. Under Henderson, those symptoms by themselves are not sufficient to meet the objective element of the deliberate indifference test.
Well, it seems to me that you can take these cases and the language in them. If you have a broken arm or you've been raped or something of that sort where the damage is done and it doesn't make any difference whether you treat it now or hours from now, that's one kind of a case. But when you've got symptoms of a heart attack, which you can't tell what the symptoms really are going to prove in the end, you're required to move promptly to do something about it.
And I understand that, Your Honor. But you know, in this,
I mean, you've got to distinguish between these various ailments that you may have.
Certainly, that is absolutely the case. And again, in fact, this was not a heart attack. You know, and this was a case where he did receive treatment.
Well, you say it wasn't a heart attack. He had arrhythmias, apparently, and he had problems with his heart. He didn't have an infarction or a clot in his
right.
Coronary artery. That's one definition of a heart attack. But he did have some problems with the with his heart, didn't he?
He did. He did have some problems with the heart, and he was treated. He was seen. This is not
eventually,
a case.
Yeah.
That's
after
true, but this
collapsed,
is not a case
yeah.
of a complete denial of treatment. This is a case of a delay in treatment. This is not a delay of months. It's not a delay of weeks. It's not a delay of days. It's not a delay of a day. It's a delay of 6 hours to check on his chest pain stemming from his hypertension. in that situation where we're dealing with not the failure to treat before a heart attack happens, what we're dealing with a delay in treatment, which he did receive, which he did get checked out, and which he was fine, and which and he was monitored, in that situation, we get into the Langston rule, the requirement that where there is a delay in the provision of medical treatment, for that delay to constitute an objectively serious, i.e. an extreme deprivation, a deprivation that deprives the inmate of the minimal civilized measure of life's necessities, the inmate must submit verifying medical evidence that the delay made his medical condition worse. That's the Langston rule. That's what we are where we have a delay in treatment.
It's like, Williams was in his cell and making these complaints that we have here, and they weren't acted on. Let's say the complaints are made in the evening and nothing happens till the morning. That would speak to delay, as you've spoken of. But here we have delay mixed with instructions to continue on with a physical activity. Now, does that, when we have these complaints as of the type we have here, and we have instructions or actions or inaction with regard to attending to it, but then commanding to continue a performance, doesn't that kind of tweak the delay situation somewhat?
That can tweak the delay situation, I think, certainly. But my belief is where that comes in is after there's the verifying medical evidence. Once you have verifying medical evidence, then you entertain other factors, such as the reason for the delay, what happened during the delay, the extent of the effect of the delay. But it's our position that you get into those situations, those considerations, once you have the verifying medical evidence that during this delay, his condition was in fact made worse. If it's a case where there is a delay and there are instructions, for instance, to, as in this case, move your bedding, you know, climb up the stairs, change cells, basically, you know, and even with that, the effect still is no detrimental effect on the health condition. The result is the same. The result is still the failure to satisfy the objective part of the deliberate indifference test under Langston. And indeed, Williams presented no evidence whatsoever. He did not meet his burden that of proving that this delay coupled with even the instructions that he received, his cell move, had a detrimental effect on his medical condition. He had chest pains that were chalked up to hypertension. That's true. But there was no verifying medical evidence that the delay and whatever happened during the delay exacerbated the medical condition. Instead, Dr. Dowdy testified to the opposite. He was asked, would a five-hour delay in treating these symptoms, have a detrimental effect? His answer was, not in this case, no. That's it. That is the extent of the medical evidence in this record. And that is simply insufficient for Williams to satisfy the first prong of deliberate indifference. Now, Williams does not seem to argue that the delay did have a detrimental effect on his condition. Instead, he argues that during this time, during the delay, he argues that he was in pain. And that may be. But it's frequently the case that an individual waiting for treatment will experience discomfort or pain. But that does not do away with the Langston rule. That would completely get rid of the rule. It is true that while you wait for treatment, you may be in discomfort, you may be in pain. The question, though, the question facing this court, the question that Williams had to answer, which he failed to, was whether the delay, even though he's in pain, whether that delay made his medical condition worse. The way that he shows that is by producing verifying medical evidence, and he simply did not do that. The second reason the district court erred in denying the motion for judgment as a matter of law is that the defendants were entitled to qualified immunity. It is clear that Williams must prove, he must establish the existence of a particularized right. He must prove that it was well established. It was obvious and clearly set forth on October 27th, 2000, that a six-hour delay in treating his hypertension violated the Eighth Amendment. This proof must be made in the specific context of this case and not as a broad generality. Williams did not meet this burden. As of October 27th, 2000, this court had issued a year before the Henderson case, which indicated that chest pains, dizziness, breathing problems were not a sufficiently objectively serious medical need to satisfy the first prong of the deliberate indifference test. And several years before, this court had issued Langston, which required verifying medical evidence whenever there was a delay in treatment. Clearly, at the time these incidents occurred, the defendants were not on notice. Williams did not establish the existence of a particularized right, and he offers no case law to the contrary. For those reasons, then, even if there was a constitutional violation here, these defendants were entitled to qualified immunity under Henderson and under Langston, which were, you know, which had been issued and which were the law at the time of the incidents in this case on October 27th, 2000. If Your Honors have no further questions, I reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Ms. Bruch?
Good morning, Your Honors. Julie Brooke on behalf of the plaintiff. Under the standard that is suggested by the state and by the defendants in this case, it would appear that Mr. Williams would have had to have essentially died in order to have a serious medical condition. And that's not the standard that is set forth either by this court or by the United States Supreme Court. Back in 1976 in Estelle versus Gamble, the United States Supreme Court discussed the obligation under the Eighth Amendment on deliberate indifference. And they talk about the fact that the obligation to provide medical care to inmates extends to two different situations. The first is when the denial of care actually produce physical torture or lingering death or something of that sort of nature, and then also to a situation where the denial of medical care may result in pain and suffering that no one suggests serves any purpose related to the prison. And here we're really in that second scenario where the pain and suffering that was suffered by Mr. Williams really would have no purpose related to the jail, and in fact the actions of the corrections officers in this case exacerbated the symptoms and the problems that he was experiencing. Since the Estelle versus Gamble case, there's been a number of cases that have been decided by this circuit that discuss the fact that denial of pain medication and denial of medical care when an inmate is suffering symptoms such as Mr. Williams, that would certainly suggest a violation of the Eighth Amendment. The defendants have focused on the Langston case, which discusses the need for verifying medical evidence, and we would suggest that that Langston decision is limited to the scenario where it's not obvious that there is the objective serious medical condition here. And really the focus should be on, because the case is on the argument of the jury was should not have ruled in the way that it did, what was the jury instructions in the case? Back in 2005, the Seventh Circuit came forth with pattern jury instructions that discuss what the standard is for juries to decide whether there's been a denial of medical care. And under Seventh Circuit Instruction 7.12 and 7.13, which are the instructions that were tendered by the court at the jury trial, the standard is the same as Estelle versus Gamble and Farmer versus Brennan, which plaintiff had a serious medical need, defendant was deliberately indifferent to that serious medical need, and defendant's conduct caused harm to plaintiff. There's nothing in the jury instruction that requires a jury to determine that there's verifying medical evidence to support that. And then if you go on to 7.13, it discusses certain factors that a jury should take into account in order to make that determination. And the four factors are the severity of the condition. In this case, you have someone who is experiencing classic symptoms of a potential heart attack. Second, the harm, including pain and suffering, that could result from the lack of medical care. Well, even the corrections officers in this case testified that they recognized that based on the symptoms Mr. Williams was describing, that those symptoms could be indicative of a heart attack and that should result in immediate medical attention for him. The third factor the jury should consider was whether providing treatment was feasible. Obviously, that was the case here because the corrections officers all said that they had a radio on their duty belt that they could immediately summon medical help for him. And the fourth factor that the jury considered under the pattern jury instructions was the actual harm caused by the lack of medical care. There was certainly evidence and record of actual harm to Mr. Williams. The testimony was that not only was he eventually carrying this several hundred-pound box upstairs, he fell down. Then, at that point, medical attention is summoned. The physicians determine that he has elevated blood pressure, verifying medical evidence. The medical records show that he had a low blood flow. Again, that's verifying medical evidence. The medical records showed that he was prescribed, I believe, six medications, many of which he was not taking previously, again, verifying medical evidence, and he spent 6 days in the hospital. I mean, certainly I think that it's reasonable to suggest that people that have high blood pressure or other similar conditions that are controlled by medications don't normally spend 6 days in the hospital as a result of those conditions. So certainly there's verifying medical evidence, and the jury was entitled to determine that the conduct of the defendants actually caused harm to him. And if you look at the Langston case itself is relying on decision from the Eighth Circuit, and then that goes back to a decision from the Eleventh Circuit. And it's interesting because the Eleventh Circuit decision, which is Hill versus DeKalb Regional Youth Center, discusses the fact that one of the factors that a court can consider is the seriousness of an inmate's medical needs, and that also may be decided by reference to the effect of the delay in treatment. So essentially what the Hill Court is saying is that that's one of the factors that you can consider to decide whether you've established the objective test. It's not an absolute factor that you must decide, but it's one of the factors. That language was transferred in the Langston case to a must, which there essentially is no basis to find that that is certainly a requirement. And, in fact, given the language in the Estelle versus Gamble case, that denial of medical care may result in pain and suffering, which no one would suggest serves any purpose, and that would violate the Eighth Amendment, then, again, you've got no issue here because of the fact that there is verifying medical evidence and there certainly is objective evidence that he had a serious medical condition. And on the issue of qualified immunity, again, there are a slew of cases that are cited in our brief that support the argument that this should have been well known to the corrections officers that their conduct violated the Constitution, and they also certainly were aware that their conduct should have resulted in their obtaining immediate medical care for Mr. Williams. So if there are no questions, I would urge this court to affirm the decision of the trial court. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. A couple points. First, regarding the Langston decision, counsel argues that Langston should be limited to situations where it's not obvious that there is an objectively serious medical need. That's simply not how Langston has been read. Nothing in the language of Langston requires that. And in fact, this court's application of Langston several years afterwards, I think 6 years afterwards, in Walker versus Benjamin, would indicate the contrary, would indicate that there is, in fact, no such limitation. In Walker, we had an inmate who had a hand injury that was infected, that was discharging pus. That's not a situation where there is no objectively serious medical need and no obvious medical need. You know, Langston is just not so limited, and there's no reason, in fact, to limit it. Indeed, You know, counsel certainly argues that Langston should not be a requirement. The verifying medical evidence should not be a requirement. But what this ignores is a couple basic principles.
Well, before you move there, what do you say to counsel's argument that there is this verifiable evidence?
Okay, Your Honor. Absolutely. Counsel argues that there was verifying medical evidence that Williams had elevated blood pressure, low blood flow, he received prescriptions, and he spent 6 days in the hospital. None of that evidence indicates that any of those symptoms or any of that situation was caused by the delay, that the delay may had a detrimental effect on the medical condition. And that, in fact, is the verifying medical evidence that is required. Verifying medical evidence that the delay had a detrimental effect. There is definitely verifying medical evidence as to what his symptoms were.
If action had been taken early, are you suggesting that we still might have had the same results? In other words, if...
Yes, I'm suggesting that, and I'm suggesting more to the point, in fact, that it was Williams' burden to produce evidence that we wouldn't have had the same results had action been taken earlier. And even though it's not our burden, we still had the evidence of Dr. Dowdy, which said that had action been taken earlier, we would have had the same results. Dr. Dowdy said there was no detrimental effect on the medical condition caused by the delay.
It seems to me all of this ignores the element of risk. By delaying treatment in the case of a heart attack, you run the risk of death, it seems to me.
That is true.
You know, any doctor will tell you that, I think.
Again, you know, that's true. But on the facts of this case, in this particular case, there was no detrimental effect of the delay. Thankfully, if it would have been, you know, certainly we don't want a situation where, you know, we delayed treatment and then Williams has a heart attack. Now, and if he would have had verified medical evidence that the delay caused him to have a heart attack, it'd be an entirely different situation. And that's an entirely different factual situation that from this case, where there was no such evidence, where the evidence indicated the contrary concerning the delay.
I think that perhaps the delay here triggered the... we wouldn't have him falling backwards down the stairs. I mean,
That's true. We wouldn't have him falling backwards down the stairs.
Assuming altered his medical condition somewhat. I understand the doctor feels his overall condition would not have been altered. I mean, his general physical, but that's kind of an injury that could have been avoided.
Your Honor, I'm out of time, but may I answer your question? Thank you. The fall down the stairs, you know, there was no medical evidence that he was injured by the fall down the stairs. There was no evidence of cuts or bruising. There was no evidence that the fall down the stairs had a negative impact on him. If this was a situation where a guard pushed an inmate down the stairs and he had no cuts or bruises, we wouldn't even be here. It would not be a situation where we would have a constitutional violation. And the same applies to this case. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the...